and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for being with us again this week. Tonight I have with us Dr. Alicia Smith from Emory University's Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences Department. And we're going to talk about her works in psychiatric genetics. How are you, Dr. Smith?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Listen, I'm honored to have you here, and you're working on such exciting things. I'm really looking forward to having you. So before we get started, would you just tell us a little bit about you, where people can find you and your work that you're doing, and how to contact you if they were to have a question?
Absolutely. A little bit about myself is my training is not in psychiatry, but actually in human genetics, and I have been a faculty member at Emory since 2008. Before that, I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the CDC, and I got a PhD in molecular genetics from Wake Forest University. I currently run the Human Psychiatric Genetics Lab at Emory University, and if anyone is interested, the website is psychiatry.emory.edu/SmithLab. And if you'd like to go to psychiatry.emory.edu, you can also find information on ongoing clinical studies and ways that you can be involved in the research we're going to talk about today. You can also email me at alicia.smith, alicia.smith@emory.edu.
So you would go to clinical studies, is that what you said, to be able to? All right. I'm just looking at this as you tell me to make sure I understand it when we hang up the phone. So if you would, we've been doing like a series on early detection and prevention of disease since June. And one of the topics that we're particularly interested here is methylation and genetics. So I'm just going to kind of let you go, and I'll interrupt you with questions if that's okay. And you might want to start in telling us, what is methylation? You know, what is it that you're looking at, and what is it that you're finding, and how can it affect our lives, and what can we do about it from your research so far?
Okay. Well, I guess I'm going to start with saying that the common problem in medical research is the more you understand something, the more complicated it gets. So DNA methylation is actually a type of an epigenetic modification. And what that means is it's not a sequence variant. It's not a mutation. It is a chemical modification to a piece of DNA that helps control whether or not a gene is expressed. And when the gene is expressed, it can be expressed in all sorts of ways, and that helps to create proteins and all of the wonderful things that make us who we are. DNA methylation occurs at a very specific sequence called a CTG site. It's where two base pairs of DNA line up next to each other, and it happens really commonly all throughout your genes. And it happens in lots of places, and that mechanism is involved in turning genes on and off on a cell-by-cell basis, kind of like the gas pedal on your car. You know, you can go
ask
kind
you a question?
Sure.
And I'll do that occasionally, so I don't mean to interrupt, but I don't know when you're going to take a breath, so I'm sorry. Does everyone pretty much have the same genes, and it's just a matter of whether they express or not, or do some of us have genetic, let's take the majority of the people with the MTHFR problems that are gone. Do most of the people have those genes, or do most of the people just have them switched on or off? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Most people have the same complement of genes. Everybody's got a relatively similar genetic structure. We are more than 99% genetically similar to the person sitting next to us. What changes is subtle variation within the gene sequences, and then how turned on those genes are, and you know, to what degree they're expressed, and that's what epigenetics plays a role in.
So what makes them turn on or off? Is it nutrition, or is it some conditioning that happens in our lives? What is it?
Well,
is it both?
We're still kind of working on that. The relationship between all of the millions of places where a gene can be methylated. There's a million different places this can happen throughout your whole genome, and that's happening in every single cell of your body. And it's not clear which one of those, what exactly they do. I can tell you that DNA methylation turns on different genes in different tissues. And so that's one of the reasons why, even though every cell of your body has the exact same genome, your stomach cells act differently from your brain cells, act differently from your skin cells. They all have a different purpose. And the which genes are turned on and sort of the specific function of that tissue is determined by epigenetics. And most genes are silenced for most of the time. But you've actually hit the nail on the head for what my research is, which is looking at how the environment changes what's expressed by changing DNA methylation.
So before you get into that, you have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 words that you use in the beginning of the paper that you sent me. And I'd like for you to tell me what those words mean. Acetylation, and I may not pronounce all these right, methylation, phosphorylation, smoylation?
Smoylation.
What are they? You know which words I'm talking about. What are they?
I do. So DNA methylation is only one type of epigenetic modification. There's a lot of them. And epigenetics is this class of chemical modifications to your genes that allow them to turn on and off when they're supposed to. And it's all very normal. Your genes turning on and off when they're supposed to is the reason why we can form memories. It's the reason why we can learn. But the other types of epigenetic modifications are acetylation, phosphorylation, thymoylation, ubiquitination, and biotinylation, and there's so many more. And they all act sort of as a unit. DNA methylation is a drop in the bucket for epigenetics, but the other words that you talked about, the acetylation, phosphorylation, and even a different type of methylation, are things that are modifications that happen to the protein that your DNA is wrapped around. And so the modification to DNA itself is methylation.
Sometime before the end of this show, I'm not going to make you go there now because I think it's kind of out of sequence, but I'd like for you to tell us, if you know, nutritional values attached to each one of these, if you know, and if you don't, that's okay too. So, and whenever you think that's appropriate to fit it in. So why don't you just go from here and tell us about your work? Most of your work is in some kind of psychological disorders, addictions, mood disorders, you know, depressions. If you could just tell us what you're doing now, I'd love to know that.
I would be happy to. A lot of what we do is looking at how DNA method. So I guess the place to start is to say that I'm not a treatment provider. I don't offer medical advice or see patients. What I am is a population researcher. And what that means is I look for statistical trends in large groups of people.
Let me just do a protective thing here. I forgot to do this at the beginning. Dr. Smith, even though she's a doctor, she's not a medical doctor, she's a research scientist, neither one of us are attempting to treat or diagnose you. We're providing this information for that reason, for informational purposes only. I just want to make that clear because I don't want to get, you know, any legal things going on down the road.
Okay. Well, what I am is I'm a population researcher, and so what I do is we look at hundreds of individuals at a time, and we identify DNA methylation patterns that are common to mood disorders, anxiety disorders, all the way across the lifespan. So where we actually start looking at the beginning is in fetal development, because DNA methylation has a role in fetal development too. It's actually a mechanism for how all of your tissues develop and differentiate as a fetus is growing. And things that happen during development can leave marks, sort of epigenetic marks. And there is this great hypothesis by a scientist named David Barker, who actually noticed that children who were born small for gestational age or preterm are more likely to have type 2 diabetes and stroke and heart disease when they grow up as adults. And we're finding that more and more in psychiatry, where things like schizophrenia are more common in people whose mothers had severe infections during pregnancy. And I think they've shown this for autism as well. Types of infections that involved high fever or immune responses can leave epigenetic marks, and it can be years and decades before the consequences of those epigenetic changes are clear. And we're still really just starting to evaluate it. But as an example, one of the things that we've studied is prenatal stress. And prenatal stress is a very complicated subject. Children whose mothers underwent a great deal of stress or depression during their development are more likely to have ADHD and behavioral problems as children. They're more likely to have substance abuse disorders as adults and addiction problems. They're more likely to have mood disorders themselves and conduct problems. And it's not clear why that is, but we know that all of the sort of the primary stress hormone crosses the placenta. So when mom is stressed, baby is stressed. And that can have lifelong consequences. This was it was illustrated by a group of researchers in Montreal, Michael Meany's group. And what they found was they used a rat model, and they found that when you're a rat, the very best standard of maternal care is for lots of licking and grooming of your pups, and something called arch-back nursing. And those are very happy, relaxed mothers. And the pups of those rats grow up to be good moms themselves. On the other hand, bad rat moms don't lick and groom their pups. There's not that high standard of maternal care. And I guess I should say that, you know, rat pups for the first week is equivalent to about the third trimester in human development. And if you have good rat moms, the pups become good rat moms. And if you are a bad rat mom, then your pups grow up to be bad rat moms in this model. And so what they found was they took them, the pups, and they switched them at one point. So you had the pups of the good rat moms being raised by bad moms, and the pups of the bad moms were raised by good moms. And they found that it was completely reversible. So it wasn't genetic. It was something in the environment and it was something that was happening, the stress response. And they could show it through generations. It was inherited but not genetic. And
I have
they
a
linked
question
it
here. Go
sure.
ahead though. Finish your thought.
They linked it to an epigenetic change, or change in DNA methylation in the stress response part of the brain of these pups. So when there was licking and grooming and high maternal care, there was lower activation of the stress response system biochemically, and that was stable after the first 7 days. And it would be like that for their entire life.
Go ahead.
The early environment is really very important.
So the first 7 days would be equivalent to what age in a human fetus?
About the third trimester.
Oh, okay. So did you find, I interviewed somebody not too long ago, and they were talking about how in their research, it was their opinion that the period of time that seemed to be most important to try to address some of these problems would be the third trimester up into the first month of human life. Do you find that same thing in your research, or have you looked at that at all? Is there a cutoff time?
Yeah, we haven't done a whole lot in terms of timing, but I would say it probably goes further, because animals, so a lot of this work was done in animals, and I don't do animal research, but, you know, the people that do, they find a very narrow window. But human development, especially human brain development, is really very different. It occurs on a much longer scale. And we've found, you know, interventions in preschool seem to work very well. Obviously, the earlier, the better. But I wouldn't say there's a cutoff date that if you miss it, you really have to worry. The amazing thing about epigenetics is that it's potentially reversible. But every epigenetic mark, when a cell divides, is maintained. So as your cells divide and grow at a faster rate, like happens during development and childhood, things that you do in development and childhood are likely to have a longer lasting impact. And that's sort of the ideal place for intervention. But, you know, human brain development goes into the 20s.
Okay, that's so interesting. So you do, why don't you just go to your next segment here, because you have several of them. I won't interrupt you again.
It's fine. We can talk about whatever you would like.
Well, I want people to understand all of the things that let me rephrase myself. I have a lot of people that call me from all over the world telling me that they've been diagnosed with this or that or this or that or this. And it's my perspective that these diagnoses are typically some kind of label for most probably the problems that you're talking about, and that just because something has a label doesn't mean that there's something they can't do about it. So I want you to go ahead and finish talking about your work, if you would.
That's absolutely true. Just because there's something that has a label doesn't mean, I'm really strongly believe that just because there's a label doesn't mean there isn't a way to treat it and a way to change. So in terms of other things that affect your DNA methylation, we've done studies to show that there are different patterns of DNA methylation in children who have been abused, who are more likely to go on to develop psychiatric disorders, in people who are under high stress levels. And part of that is actually because there is a connection between your stress response and your immune system. And so some of the epigenetic changes that we observe could be related to immune changes. And I think everybody's heard what is it actually an urban myth, but during final season for college students, they're more likely to get colds, they're more likely to get sick. And the reason for that is because stress actually suppresses your immune system. And so you're more likely to catch things, viruses, bacteria, you know. And so if you're under chronic stress, if you're stressed every day, your immune system is initially depressed, and then you have a tendency to respond with inflammation. And inflammation is your body's way of protecting yourself in a non-specific manner to just set up a fence around yourself and try to keep you from getting ill. And that's, you know, the best you can do in a really stressful situation. There are other things that we do to ourselves other than stress that also increase inflammation and the epigenetic changes that go with it. A lot of the inflammation-related DNA methylation is on a feed-forward loop. So the longer you have it, the harder it is to get rid of. And an example of this is smoking. So that's actually one of the most replicable findings, is people who smoke have marks in their DNA methylation at specific genes that are involved in trying to clear toxins from your body. And so those genes, you know, they turn on in certain ways, they activate, and you can see that even after a person's quit smoking, that your body is still sort of responding to clearing those toxins.
And how do you see this? I'm curious.
We can measure it in the lab. In order to study DNA methylation in a lot of people, we can extract a piece of DNA, and then we can look at the percentage of a person's cells that has DNA methylation at a specific site.
Wow, that's wonderful. So that's, I just got to say this, that's not the same kind of thing as 23andMe, right?
No. 23andMe is looking at sequence variants. And what we do in my lab is actually, for most of our studies, we look at about 485,000 individual CpG sites in all of your genes, and then look for patterns among those.
So how well can you early predict? Well, how far along are you at being able to early detect or prevent, say, addiction or cutting disorders or what? Just pick one. PTSD, heart disease, whatever you want to pick. Just pick one.
I wish I could say we were already there, but we're not quite yet. We are, so I guess a big concept is, I said that that DNA methylation is different in all of your tissues. And obviously for something like a brain-based disorder, we can't test that in a person because, well, they're using their brain. And we don't want to take a piece of it, right? It's not ethical and it's not safe. So what we do is we actually look for...
Hold on, I have to ask this question now. This is kind of like a big question to me. You know, there's a lot of research out there now saying that gut is the second brain, that you have more neurotransmitters made in your gut than you do in your brain. That brain, you know, is literally an organ like the heart that's just processing some pieces of information. I guess my first question here is that, do you perceive, is it your opinion that that's true or false or somewhere in between? And secondly, if you were to happen to say that it is true, could you not check some of those things in the gut?
We are, actually.
I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
It does. It does. And actually, I want to spend some time on that. So let me finish up on the previous. And I wanted to say that what we're actually looking for is what we call biomarkers. So we can look in DNA from spit or DNA from blood and try to identify patterns that predict something associated with the disease state. And there's actually been quite a few studies by Zachary Kaminsky at Johns Hopkins, a collaborator and friend of mine, who has identified some of these patterns that seem to predict postpartum depression and seem to predict suicidal behaviors. And we're working actually now on something to predict anxiety. And so I think it'll be quite a while before these things are validated and can be used clinically, because obviously you have to show that it's predictive in so many different people in order to feel confident enough to use it in a clinic. But we are getting to that point now, and that's actually a very exciting time.
Absolutely.
So to get back to the gut, I really like the idea of the gut as a second brain. And I don't, there are a lot of neurotransmitters that signal throughout the whole body, right? Neurotransmitters don't just allow us to do higher order executive function, but the neurotransmitters are, they keep our smooth muscle contracting. They keep our gut working. They keep our stomach pumping. And, you know, all of the things that we don't think neurotransmitters do, they regulate our blood pressure. I know there are certain types of serotonin receptors that are pretty much exclusively in the stomach. And we think of serotonin as one of those things that help control our mood, but in fact, it helps control our digestion as well. I think the reason why some people say the gut is a second brain is they're actually talking about the microbiome. And do you know that term?
Say again, please.
The microbiome?
No, but I'd like to know.
Well, so we are ourselves, but we're actually colonized by a lot of bacteria, sort of symbiotic bacteria. And nowhere is that more true than in the gut. And we use this gut bacteria to help break down different foods. And a common example, one that everybody likes, is lactobacillus. And
oh, okay.
Lactobacillus,
I understand that.
Right. They're probiotics. Lactobacillus is a type of bacteria. It lives in your gut. It helps you digest dairy products and other things. And the balance of the bacteria in your gut actually has a lot to do with your peripheral inflammation and your overall health. And that's, I think, becoming more commonly recognized. And I'm actually very excited that we have just started a study where we're looking at preterm birth in women, and we're going to be collecting DNA methylation, but also microbiome information. So we'll be able to see how differences in the bacterial content in their gut, how that relates to DNA methylation in their immune system.
So
that's a very cutting edge.
So I want to ask you another question, just because my listeners are very interested in this, and the door has kind of been open. And when you talked about the brain thing, and this is a little bit off topic, but you're just such an appropriate person to ask this question. Do you think where do you think consciousness lies? What is that? Does the brain think, or does it process? It is off topic.
Does the brain think, or does it process?
Yeah.
I don't know that they're different.
Okay.
I'm not sure what you mean, and I'm very literal and scientific, and also not a psychiatrist or a neuroscientist, so they may have a better answer. But I think, personally, that what we perceive as thoughts are chemically motivated, but I don't think that makes it any less cool.
I just had to throw. I wrote a book about consciousness one time, and so I just had to ask that question. But I'm not going to get you off topic. I promise.
<It's fine.
laughs> I promise I won't do that. So let's go back to your work and talk about what are some things that you use to reverse a gene that's expressing that shouldn't be. Do you use pharmaceuticals? Do you use nutraceuticals? What do you use? Do you use psychotherapy? What do you do?
So I don't personally do any of it, but there are options. And we're only just now getting to the point where we can start trying to do things specifically. So if you have a particular gene and you know that particular gene is not behaving as you would like it to, we're now just getting the technology to do something specific. Before that, what people did are a few different things. One, people try cognitive behavioral therapy and other types of therapy, yoga and meditation and massage and all sorts of behavioral and stress-reducing interventions to help. We're only getting to the point where we have any particular understanding of what those processes do to your biology. And we're actually starting another study that I'm excited about, looking at gene expression and epigenetic changes after massage, 6 weeks of massage. And that should be very interesting. There's great preliminary data. But I think the best, I guess, most effective ways, if you're targeting genes, is to do it through medication or nutrition. And medication, there are a class of medication called histone deacetylase inhibitors, called HDAC inhibitors. They're being used to treat cancer. They've been used to treat a number of psychiatric disorders, also neurological disorders, seizure disorders, migraines, bipolar disorder. The class that I'm most familiar with and have done research on is anti-epileptic drugs, also called mood stabilizers. They're things like Depakote or valproic acid, lamotrigine, carbamazepine, and they change histones. So when we talked earlier about acetylation as one of those other types of epigenetic modification that happens to proteins, this class of medication affects histone acetylation for that protein, and it changes DNA methylation along with it. And it does it nonspecifically, but those types of medications have been very effective for treating a number of different psychiatric and neurological disorders. And now they're being looked at specifically to treat cancer as well. The problem with that is they're systemic. They don't target any one tissue, any one gene. But they are quite effective. The other way to do it is through nutrition. And there's been less research on this, but I did a study with Lynn Bailey at UGA looking at folate supplementation in women of childbearing years who were trying to lose weight. And my personal bias is that there is no substitute for proper diet, that you can take vitamin C in a pill, in a supplement, but you don't always get all of the cofactors and the other nutrients that go along with it if you would just eat an orange. And that's the thing about biochemistry, is we identify one thing important, and we don't always know about all of the other pieces of the puzzle that are required to make it really effective.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, but now I have to ask you another question. And I'm totally with you on that. I totally agree. So my question is now, if you're using pharmaceuticals, you know, some pharmaceuticals, particularly, you know, these kind of pharmaceuticals, they rob you, well, any kind, I guess, they rob you of other nutrients. So when doing a study like that, do you also replace the nutrients that it robs? Does that make sense, that question?
I'm not sure. So are you talking about anti-epileptics?
I don't know
or
anything about anti-epileptics.
Pharmaceuticals in general?
Pharmaceuticals in general. Well, let's just say a statin, and I know that's not your area, but it's the only thing that pops in my mind right here, being on the spot. You know, it robs you of certain things like CoQ10 and certain amino acids. So people write out those prescriptions for those things, but they don't say, oh, by the way, it's going to mess this up, so we need to fix, you know, supplement that too. So if you're doing pharmaceuticals for, I'm looking at your, the NIH research page here, and they recommend particular drugs in some of this research. And if the person's already struggling with the mood disorder and they start taking this pharmaceutical and it robs them of other things, you know, that's going to cause a cascade of events down the road. Do they take that into consideration when they do it? The researchers, do they take that into consideration?
Not.
Or do you know?
Probably not, actually. So the way most pharmaceuticals are developed is they're developed to be efficacious in the largest percentage of people possible without having overwhelming side effects. What they don't do is they don't do what we call personalized medicine. And so that's actually a growing trend in medicine. It's also sometimes called pharmacogenetics. And it's not just identifying the best drug for most, it's targeting the best drug for a person. And so some people, based on their genetic makeup, based on their diet, their biology, they're going to respond differently to a particular medication. Mm-hmm. They're going to need a different dose. They're going to have more or worse side effects. Sometimes the side effects are going to be so bad that you're going to have to try a different one. And an example of that is warfarin. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
It's a clotting drug. And mm-hmm. and it's actually one of the key drugs that they do personalized treatment for, because the amount of vitamin K in your diet influences what your dose would be. Your genetics influence what your dose would be really strongly. Whether or not you smoke, what your weight is, what your race is. And so there are actual algorithms that you could use or that your doctor can use to calculate what is the best for you. And they don't do that with all drugs. And I think there's a call to do it, but it's not clear how to do it for all of them.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. I'm a natural person, me, but I was attracted to your work because it's the research end of it, but I had to ask those questions. Hope that's all right with you.
Oh, yeah,
so
sure.
Let's go back to your research, and we have about 15 minutes, and I just want you to talk about whatever you think is important to talk about. Whatever you'd like. What would you like people to know?
What I would like people to know is that DNA methylation is a very natural part of the regulation of different parts of your body. And when it goes wrong, it's not always clear. It's not always clear whether a difference in DNA methylation is good or bad, or whether it does nothing at all. The research is largely out on a lot of it, but we're getting there. And
what can you? Oh, sorry, I thought you were finished.
Sure.
Go ahead.
No, please.
Say, what can you know? One of the hottest topics in the world right now, for the average treating physician and the average person walking around, particularly in this country, is MTHFR. What can you know? Today, they're running lab tests unless you know to go and get a better lab test that says yes, you have MTHFR, or no, you don't. And then the doctor automatically writes a prescription for folate and B12. Doesn't look at, are you undermethylating? Are you overmethylating? You know, maybe you need folate, maybe you don't. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and that's actually because I don't think they know at this point whether you're undermethylating, whether you're overmethylating, because they don't know what normal is. And that's one of the reasons why we do these population-based studies. I know for MTHFR, there are a number of different genotypes that affect the rate and the efficiency of your MTHFR enzyme, which is really important. But even people who, you know, with rare exception, you have even people who are sort of homozygous for the genotype that is considered most deleterious, the, what is it, the 677 CT. If you have two copies of the T allele, it means you have a less efficacious enzyme. It doesn't mean you don't have any. When they do large studies, they found no difference based on genotype in the average level of methylation that that person has. Now, you'd want to look at individual genes and things like that, but on average, methylation is largely the same no matter what your genotype is. And I guess to say it's largely the same means that we can't detect a difference. And so I wouldn't worry all that much. I would say that if you have sort of the risk genotype, that if you're concerned, to keep in mind that it's actually very common. 10% or more of the population is in the same boat. And if it were a really dangerous mutation, it wouldn't be that common. But there are things that you can do. There are, if you're concerned, there are diet options that you can try that will help make you feel better. Things that I think would be good for your peace of mind and good for you physically. I guess the other thing I might encourage your listeners to do is to get involved in research, because we work very hard to recruit people into research studies, and it's a very hard thing to do. And the more people and the more variety of people we have in research studies, the more we'll be able to learn, and the more effective sort of treatment and diet and lifestyle interventions we could recommend. And I say we as the, you know, the scientific team.
Right. I'm looking at your, tell me again how to find that page. because I'm looking at it. I'm on your page right now that says Alicia K. Smith, assistant professor. Where do I go from here to find it?
If I sent you the website, would you be interested? Do you have a website you could post it on?
Yes.
Okay. So the place to go is psychiatry.emory.edu. And the tab you want to click on is Research. And under Research, there is a tab for Ongoing Clinical Trials.
Okay, I see that.
And those are the clinical studies that are happening right now.
Does someone have to take drugs, or can they just help you do your research without taking drugs?
Oh, no, no. So there's a couple of different ways to do it. Some of these are medication trials, but others are looking for healthy volunteers because every good experiment needs a control group. And if you have a relative with a mood disorder and you want to help them out, then consider volunteering as a healthy control. Also, there are a lot of alternative treatments that are now being studied, including massage, which I mentioned before. Another one that's very common is compassion-based meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there may be a trial or studies on fish oils and dietary supplements.
Where would that be? I see pregnancy and newborn follow-up, decision-making and major depression for healthy volunteers, biomarker to diagnose major depressive disorder, behavioral interventions for emotional well-being and medical health. So where would fish oils be?
I don't know that one's still enrolling, but I could look into it.
Because I would be happy to share this with a lot of people. So I know a lot of people that, you know, want to help get better, want to help the world get better. So if you would check, and if you do have it, send it to me, and I'll be delighted to share it.
Absolutely.
Right. We have 5 minutes or 6 minutes left. Anything that you want to make sure you cover? If not, I'll ask you. I was kind of interested in your paragraph on COMT. Could you talk about it?
Absolutely. So COMT is, I think, another one that we've discussed before, another genetic polymorphism that has something to do with methylation. It's catecholamine methyltransferase, and there is a very common polymorphism. And we call it a polymorphism and not a mutation because it's so common within the population. A mutation is typically something very rare and sort of bad for you. But a polymorphism is something that, you know, is in 1% or more of the population, and in this case, it's actually quite common. So it's a genetic polymorphism that changes your amino acid within your gene. And what those amino acid changes tend to do is they change the structure of a protein. And when you change the structure of a protein, you change the way it works. And in this case, the enzyme, the COMT enzyme, is less active when you have one version of it versus the other. And that has a tendency to decrease dopamine signaling in your brain, and a number of catecholamine signaling. So other catecholamines are epinephrine, norepinephrine. One version of the enzyme is less stable and therefore less active. And it does so because when you change the amino acid, you also create a methylation site. And so not only are you changing the structure of the protein, but you're adding methylation on top of it.
So what does that mean? I know you just told us, but you told me over my head. So what does that mean?
I'm sorry.
And then I want you to tell us, so I don't mean to interrupt you, but we have, like I said, about 6 minutes. I wouldn't mind you revisiting your folate study and telling us what kind of folate you did the study with and what kinds you recommend. But anyway, go ahead.
So what it means is if you have one version of this, you have more of a certain type of neurotransmitters in your brain for longer.
So do you have more dopamine or less dopamine?
Well, with one version of it, you have more dopamine because what this enzyme does is it degrades them. And so it would take dopamine and it would chew it up into an inactive form.
Oh, okay.
And so if that enzyme is less active, then you have more dopamine because it's not chewed up as quickly.
And what kind of symptoms would people get? Because I just want people to understand there are so many little snippets that just, it's not just MTHFR. There's many, many other things. COMT just happens to be one, right?
Right, exactly. And people with that particular variant, actually it's been studied in a number of mood disorders. It's been studied in schizophrenia. It's more common in people with schizophrenia. It's more common in people with depression and bipolar disorder, though it's not always. And we actually, my lab found that in it affects fear inhibition. So being afraid, being anxious, things like phobias and post-traumatic stress disorder relate to learning and learning to be afraid and then learning not to be afraid of something. And that people with one of the COMT variants actually have a harder time learning not to be afraid.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I wasn't going to say anything about this. I have double mutations there on both of them, well, on two of them, and I can tell you that's the truth. I finally learned one day, sitting on my porch in the past 6 months, actually. I was sitting on my porch, and I was like, I actually got it. I had this thought, you know, I've never played a game, and I live in fear for whatever reason. I don't want fear of this or that or this. And I finally realized, you know, I have never played a game in my life with the intention of losing. I've never intentionally played a tennis match to lose it. I've never intentionally played a Monopoly game to lose it or whatever else it is that I do. And I got it one day, you know, why would we be born or why would we choose a life or have a life? Why would, however you believe, your belief system, why would you have a life to intentionally set yourself up to fail? What would be the good there? Because perhaps as a spiritual being, you know, the goal is to ascend or to increase your awareness of who you are so you can be a better person. And when I got that one day, in an instant, it changed my ability to deal with fear. I don't know.
That's wonderful.
And it was a long, hard year, decades of struggling with fear until I had that insight one day. I don't know how it came. It just flopped down in my head, you know, like an idea. And I got it. But it changed me in an instant. Perhaps gene stopped expressing. I don't know.
Well, you know, scientists actually ask themselves the same question. And so the first thing I can tell you is you're not alone. There's actually a large part of the population who's got the same genetic makeup in this gene in terms of, you know, that polymorphism. And you're in good company. One of the reasons why scientists think that these types of genetic variants, you know, haven't been selected out, right? We think about things as we evolve, and things that are really bad for us are less likely to persist in our genetic makeup as you know, our population evolves over, you know, hundreds of generations. But this one, they think is actually, it can be protective. It can be a good thing. So if you live in a really stressful environment, you're more likely, if you have this polymorphism, or this particular genotype, you're more likely to be wary in a dangerous situation, and that's an appropriate response. You're more likely to be vigilant. You're more likely to pay attention. You're more likely to be active. So if there's a group of people where having more neurotransmitters is actually a selective advantage in some environments. And
that makes a lot of sense. Right?
Yeah. And if it may mean that you do a better job at, you know, paying attention to things that are threats. And there are some times where that's a really good trait to have.
Yeah, survival thing. Well, Dr. Smith, it's been a pleasure to have you on my show. I wouldn't mind having you back sometime if you're amenable.
I would love to come back and talk about whatever you'd like.
Thank you, and it has been a pleasure. And please send me that information, and I will share it. Okay?
Absolutely.
Have a good evening, and again, thank you for taking the time for my show and my listeners. Good night.
You have a good evening, too. Good night.